following discussion occurred in Westcliff, Colorado, late in the summer of 1967. The subject of the interview is Mrs. Beardsley, an ex-resident of Custer County. Mrs. Riggs is doing the interviewing.
Well, this afternoon we have the honor and pleasure of interviewing an ex-resident of Custer County. Miss Beardsley, will you state your name and age, please?
Pauline Beardsley, 65 years old. I was born September the 27th, 1901.
And can you tell me exactly where you were born?
In the house that Otto Walter lives in now.
That's good. Now we know exactly where.
Exactly.
At home.
At home.
You were born at home. Was there a doctor?
Dr. Baldwin was the doctor.
See? And you grew up then right in the town of Westcliff?
Right in the town of Westcliff in the same house.
Oh, all your life?
All my life until we left in 1941.
Mm-hmm. So, Clarkson to adulthood. That's a little unusual. How many were there in your family?
Just my brother and myself.
And your brother's in Colorado?
Colorado Springs.
And your father was a banker?
Yes.
All his life?
Yes. Most of yes, he was. Mm-hmm.
And he had the bank here in Westcliff?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And were there other banks?
Not at the time he came. There had been other banks. There had been a bank, I think there had been two banks in Rosita and also one in Silver Cliff. But at the time my father came, there was no bank in the county.
What year was this?
He came on the 19th of April, 1890.
Oh, my. You really have
so,
the dates down.
So that I have that, anyhow.
Very good. Can you maybe tell us anything about his life?
Well, my father was born in Pennsylvania, and as a small child, they moved to northern Illinois. And one of the families in Mount Carroll, Illinois, where they moved to, my grammar is not too hot, where they went was the Tompkins family. And there were two Tompkins brothers, H.H. Tompkins, Henry Hunt Tompkins, and Lewis Hunt Tompkins. Lewis was Dad's particular friend. Henry was a little bit older. And the two Tompkins came out to Colorado, I guess sometime in probably the early 80s, and started a chain of hardware stores all over the state of Colorado. And I'm about to lose my breath here.
All right, now we're on again, and you tell us.
And at the time, before Dad came out here, he was in a bank in South Dakota, and it was a panic or something. I don't get it was more the drought in South Dakota. They closed the bank, and he was going into a bank in Illinois. But in the meantime, his father was out here mining. Dad's father got the mining bug back in the 80s, or in the 79s, I guess it was, about 79, and came out here, and he was up in Crystal City, and also up above Gunnison somewhere. Well, Dad, before he went into this new position, came out to see his father, who was somewhere up above. Well, I guess at that time he was at Crystal, up in Crystal. And
is there Gunnison?
Well, it's in Gunnison County, but it's above Aspen. It's up in the headwaters of the Crystal River. And anyway, he had to stop in Leadville and stay there, wait for a stagecoach to take him up where he wanted to go. And walking along the street that evening, and met Henry Tompkins. And Henry asked him what he was doing, and I guess he hadn't seen him for years, but what he was doing, and he told him that he was waiting just between jobs, that he was going to this place in Illinois. Well, Henry said, "You're just the person I want. We need a bank up in the Wet Mountain Valley, and come on up and start it with me." So Dad decided he'd do it. He went over to see his father for a few days, and then was to meet Henry at Cotopaxi, but missed him. And he came up, and that was the 19th came up from Cotopaxi on the stagecoach. It was a horrible day, one of the windy, nasty days that we have, you know, in April. And his, of course, Henry Tompkins had missed the train or something. He wasn't at Cotopaxi. And Dad looked it over and said, I can't take it. And so the next day, he stayed all night. And then the next day, he was waiting for the bus or the stagecoach came up from Cotopaxi and then went back down. And he was waiting for it to come up, to go on down, back down and leave. And Henry came on it and persuaded him to stay.
All day, aren't they? Windy, cold, and miserable.
Well, that day the sun had come out and it was beautiful. So Dad decided to stay and that was it.
Wow.
And he and Lewis Tompkins, Henry Tompkins, Lewis Tompkins, and Dad put up the money for the bank. They were the three, the even partners.
I was going to ask and, you how that worked.
But yes, all three of them put up the same amount for the
bank. Well, do you have any idea of how much?
Not at the time, no. I don't even know whether we have any. At that time, I have no idea. I could find out that my brother suggested that I call the bank commissioner in Denver, but I could find out a good deal about that through records of that type. But I do know that we were capitalized to $25,000, which is very small nowadays, but in those days, it was a pretty good amount.
Well, and for three people to be able to do it was probably in the thousands of dollars they put up a piece.
Yes, but I doubt if the capitalization was as high as 25 when they first did it. Of course, you didn't need that much money in those days. It went so much farther than it does nowadays. But anyway, they were in the bank, and of course, Henry and Lewis never had anything to do with the bank at all. Dad ran it completely.
All by himself?
Well, for a while he was there alone, and then he had a man named Tom Fletcher who was with him for quite a little while. I don't know just how long, but after Tom left, Wallace Leary and was with him for quite a while. And Wallace, Henry started another bank, Henry and Lewis, I think Lewis was in it, in Creed. And they took Wallace over to Creed to run the bank over there. And then the younger Leary boy, Jack Leary, was with Dad until...
Well, he usually just had one clerk.
And then finally, after Jack Leary left, Floyd Thompson, who was our cousin, went in as a cashier and was there until he closed the bank. And, of course, my brother went into the bank after he graduated from college, and Dad died in 1924. And then my brother and I went in 1925 in the bank. And my brother and Floyd and I ran the bank until, I went in. Well, it got to be very little to do at the bank, and back in the days of the Depression of the early 30s, so I ran for county treasurer, but I was still the vice president of the bank. You had to have a certain number of people to sign the reports and whatnot, so I was still doing that, but we liquidated in 1937.
Well, let's go back just a little bit now to your dad, because you seem to really have lots of knowledge about him, and this is real good. Do you recall if he said anything about being real concerned when he first opened the bank, either about business itself and being able to keep going, which always has to be a problem?
No, Dad never felt that at all.
Well, how about bank robbers?
No, not particularly. Of course, someone did break into the bank at one time, but it was at night, and they got into the vault, of course. They didn't get into the safe. We had just gotten a shipment of Cordette had just gotten a shipment of currency. So there was a good deal in the safe, but they didn't get into that, but they did get into the vault. And we didn't have any lock boxes in the vault, but we did have drawers. And the only thing that they actually took was jewelry that was my mother's, that was in the bank at that time, that they were just keeping it there. And then a couple of other people had a few things, but not as much as this. There were quite a little jewelry of ours that was stolen. And also, we had a lot of pennies. We didn't use pennies ever. And George and I started using pennies after we took over the bank. But Dad never would use a penny. We paid to the nearest nickel. And we kept getting more pennies all the time. And there were a couple of bags of pennies, and I think they were $500, $1 bags marked on the outside. Or no, I guess they were dime bags, because they ate the feel of them where they thought that they were getting, apparently, because they took two bags of pennies. And that was all the money they got out of it. But,
do you know about what year this was? Don't worry about it if you don't. I just thought it would make it.
I would judge it was about 1922.
Did you ever have any leads on who had done it?
No. No, we didn't have anything at all.
But this area didn't seem to be very concerned ever with bad men, did it?
Well, there had been years ago. Of course, you always hear about these bad men. And at one time, I don't know whether you ever heard about them. Just a minute.
The spirit is going to tell us a little bit about her mother and that side of the family now.
My mother was, she was born in Illinois, Moline, Illinois, during one of the floods. My grandfather was gone. My grandmother was alone with the older children. Of course, she was the youngest of five daughters. And they went to Kansas. And then my grandfather was particularly interested in mining and decided to come to Colorado. And they came from Kansas to Colorado in a covered wagon. And I think my mother was around 10 or 12 years old. But anyhow, they tell about her riding her pony along next to the wagon for a great deal of the way. And she was, they lived in Rosita, and my mother went to, I think, to Boulder to college, and then taught in various school districts here. She taught
in
Custer County. She taught in Silver Cliff, she taught in Rosita, and she taught.
What was her maiden name?
Swanson. Pauline Swanson, only that she was called Lily Swanson. And they were married, Dad and my mother were married in the fall of 98. And George was born January 1900, and I was born in 1901. And my mother died in 1905.
Oh, that's too bad.
And Dad never married again, but the three of us were pretty darn close. We had a good time together. But Dad's of my mother's, Floyd Thompson's mother, was my mother's sister, and old Jim Pringle's wife was my mother's sister. And of course, Jim Pringle was one of the first people that came into the valley. He was one of the three miners that came in, Robson Pringle and Irwin, that came into Rosita.
Okay, I've heard that.
So, but anyway, that was, I think, as much as I know right now, unless you want other things.
No,
about,
what I was wondering.
Oh, another thing, my grandmother was a midwife up in in Rosita.
Oh.
And was one that was on call when anybody needed anybody, anything. And she was the midwife when Ralph Carr was born. Which I always kind of mused about.
Ralph Carr. That doesn't ring a bell in my head.
Doesn't Ralph Carr? Well, he was one of the best governors Colorado has ever had.
Oh, sorry about that. I bet he was Republican, too.
You bet he was.
Bruce will take care of me, really. Well, hey, I'm originally from Kansas. I have an excuse.
What part of Kansas?
Eastern Kansas, far eastern Kansas.
So this was Mountain Valley, where...
Valley.
And then the older sisters stayed out. Well, they came out here too for a while, and then went back again. And they were in Independence.
Oh, now Independence, I know a little bit. Just for the fun of it, would you tell me your mother's sister's name? Do they have any really nice names like Faith or Charity or you know?
No, no.
Oh,
no. They didn't. One was Augusta Tibbetts, and one was Lottie Thomas.
Now, Lottie's rather neat.
Charlotta. Well, it was who she was, Charlotta, as they called her, Lottie. And, let's see, I said there were five, there were only four of them.
Oh,
oh no, there were five. Nellie Pringle, and... Jenny Thompson and Pauline Beardsley.
How is the Jenny spelled?
Jenny, J-E-N-N-I-E. She was the one that people here in Westbrook would know more about than anything else.
Now, do you recall any real good tales they told you about the early mining days?
Well, the trouble with that, though, Mrs. Riggs.
You can't pay for it.
Well, Uncle Jim was a Scotchman.
Yes.
And Uncle Jim came out here, at least what he says, what he said. I think it's an awful shame somebody didn't write the things down that Uncle Jim told. But I have he left Scotland when he was 18 and came over here, and I don't know just what he did first, but he went to California in 59. There was a second gold rush in 59 after the 49 one. And then after that, he came back and came into Colorado. He was up in Cripple Creek. He came into Colorado on the southwestern corner up the Dolores River. And then he was in Cripple Creek, and I don't know where he met Robinson and Irwin, how he got with them. But they came over Music Pass into the valley. And Uncle Jim always told me that he named Music Pass, but the Colorado Historical Society doesn't say that. Uncle Jim also told me that he named Hardscrabble, but the Historical Society doesn't say that. Uncle Jim always said that he named Hardscrabble after the Hardscrabble Scotland where he came from. And he really told us some lovely stories, but as I say, I think he was a little colorful.
Oh, well, it sounds to me like just like somebody I'd like to hear about. Music Pass. You want me to shut it off before you tell me? But how about Music Pass? Did he say why he named it Music Pass?
They stayed all night at over on the pass, and the wind through the trees was certain the music of the pass, and so they called it Music Pass.
Now, we're going to try, with a little interference here, to explore this, the Swanson family. This was your mother's people.
Right? Yes.
Oh, now tell the story about the grandfather and how they came.
Well, they just came from Sweden. And I'm sorry, I had no idea of the time, the dates. But they came... I should know they're, of course, they are both buried in Rosita, in the Rosita Cemetery, and it's on the stone, their birth date. So when they came, they had just been married and took a sailing vessel from Sweden, and I do not know the town in Sweden they came from. But the older sister, Augusta Tibbetts, was born on the sailing vessel that they came over.
So it
Yeah, here he is.
We hope.
Well, maybe they didn't start right away.
Oh, okay.
I don't know whether it took 9 months to get here or not.
I thought I'd really pinned you down there. Let's see, I think it was Amelia Kitzman that told me her father came on a sailboat and landed in New Orleans instead of in New York, as you would, you know, yeah, normally think. Now, I believe he was from Germany, but
yes.
Anyhow, the sailboat is coming in, you know, quite frequently.
Well, I don't know just where this landed or where. They finally, I know that they did go to Moline, Illinois, and that's where my mother was born. And she was born during one of the floods in Moline, which they still have, of course. And they were completely, my grandfather had gone over to the mainland for something or other, and the flood came, and he couldn't get back. And that was the time that my mother was born.
So while he was born, yeah.
As I say, they were in Moline, Illinois, and then went to Mon Valley, Kansas. And then Grandfather Swanson became interested in mines. Just
what
as
had
my
he done before that, do you know?
He farmed in Mon Valley. And they came out in a covered wagon. And after they got in Rosita, he mined. And one of the other sisters, Lottie Thomas's husband, was up in Rosita too in the early days. And Uncle John told us about where he mined. And at one time, my brother, we still have it, but bought up rights in a claim between Rosita and Corita, and it's called the Powhatan Claim now. But George took Uncle John over to this claim at one time, and Uncle John said, well, that was the one your grandfather worked. That it was, at that time, he called it the Christine Nielsen for a singer, a Swedish singer. So we're still paying taxes
on that particular mining claim.
Well, George has a bug, but I don't.
I was going to say, mostly for sentiment or...
Well, it's for sentimental reasons. Of course, we paid taxes for years and years and years on the mines my grandfather virtually took up in Gunnison County. But
were either one of them real successful miners?
No, they never made anything out of mines.
Well, I think that's the usual story, isn't it?
Yes, really. I think it is, for the most part.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's skip now to your life, and you tell me about
my schooling was here in the grade school at Westcliff, of course. George, we didn't have a high school at that time, and George went back to Wisconsin to his father's sister and went to high school and then to the University of Wisconsin. But Dad, I tutored for a couple of years after I finished the eighth grade with the teachers that were here. And then I was sent to Denver to Wolcott's School, which was a boarding school in Denver. I graduated from there and stayed home a year and then went just 1 year to Colorado College. But Dad was alone and wasn't feeling very well, and I was not very much of a student anyhow. And I would rather stay with Dad, so I stayed home after that, and of course he died the following year. 2 years after that.
What do you recall about your early grammar school? In the way of subject matter or recess time or whatever you enjoyed most, you know?
Well, I think it was much the same as any.
You don't recall anything outstanding?
No, I really don't.
Did you have mostly women teachers?
No, we had the Westcliff School was divided into two rooms. We had what we call the little room and the big room. And the little room was the first four grades, and the big room was where the older grades. teachers were, well, I think my first teacher was May Merriam, who is
Sue Candace's sister?
Oh, no. Sue, it was...
Irma?
No. No, she was... May Merriam was a niece of Sue Candace's father's.
See, I recognized the name, and I got all and
then, too, at one time I went to kindergarten before that time to an Irene Kennigan, who was, John Comstock's mother was a Kennicott, and Irene was not that branch. She was a cousin of the Kennicotts who lived here, but she had a kindergarten. In the house that is now, that I noticed, has a sign on it, Antiques, but that's where the kindergarten was. And then as far as the other teachers are concerned, They were women, except for the big room. And in the big room, we had a man for years who was the teacher, D.C. Diggins. And he was, I think his last year was the year I graduated from the eighth grade. And then we had kind of various ones. These that I tutored with were not too good. D.C. Diggins was a pretty good teacher, I think. Anyhow, I don't remember too much that there was anything special about it, only it's kind of fun to go back to the old schoolhouse. It's much the same as it was. I haven't been there for years, but they did have a district meeting up here, a welfare district meeting at one time that they held in the old schoolhouse.
And you thought, I escaped this one. Here I am back.
Right? Here I am back, yes. It was fun to see it again.
Oh, yeah. I thought sure you would have been an avid student.
You know,
just listening to you talk, yeah, I really did. I bet she does. I'll bet that's very true.
Well, it was more fun being with Dad than it was being in college.
Well,
it was, at least it was nicer being with Dad than it was being in college.
Let's go back now. We're just skipping around here, but that's all right. You mentioned that your Uncle Jim Pringle was in the mining war, or a mining war in Rosita. And that was which mine?
The Humboldt. That I did find in the book.
Good.
Here. He was shot. He was the one, I think probably the one casualty of the war. He was shot through the foot. He couldn't go back to the war. But that is one thing that's given in these histories, any history. We'll tell you about the Humboldt.
Well, that was war. In regard to claim jumping, wasn't
yes.
it?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And
this man, well, they called him Dunk. I don't know a great deal about it, but it is in here. It tells about the jump claim and who did
and
it.
And hiring thugs, I believe, to protect it. And let's skip back to your father and the banking business. Now, was the territory when he first started banking and so forth, the main source of money, I would guess, would have been the mining industry, right?
Yes, a great deal. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that's what has been the
steady income afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there was a good deal the old Bassett was running, and the Tompkins were interested in the old Golden Mingle. Dad ran that, managed that for them for a while. And, of course, he had nothing to do with the geyser. He did manage the Bull Domingo for a while.
Oh, what about the Bull Domingo? Isn't that the one where they had the disaster fire and the...
Yes, I think so. Mm-hmm. But I don't believe that was any of the time that Dad had anything to do with it.
I believe it was later, probably.
Yes.
And I know there were four or five men trapped,
I believe so. Mm-hmm.
They couldn't get them out.
And then, too, one of the things they had was a freighting outfit from Westcliff to Cotopaxi.
This was your father?
Yeah, yes. And well, it was through the bank that we, a dad and a Tompkins brother, owned the horses. And they had, I don't know how many teams, that they freighted down to Cotopaxi.
Mostly ore, or?
Or anything. They brought up, they brought the, all of the machinery for the geyser up on these freight things. They had special wagons made for the machinery. And, well, of course, it's getting, I mean, when you start talking back 20 years ago, at least 20 years ago, they were, I saw one of those metal wagons that they had used in that freighting outfit, being used down at Texas Creek for, when you make stones out of.
Oh, granite?
Granite. They were using that same old wagon for just a little, like the wonderful one-horse shay. But it was, they had to make these special things. The heavy machinery that they brought up for the geyser had perfectly beautiful horses.
How many horses they have on a freight wagon usually?
I think there were 8-horse teams, most of them.
And that took quite a driver, didn't it?
Oh, they took a driver. Some of them, Dad said, were so good that they could turn around between the bank and those buildings in that street intersection. And some of the drivers had to go around the block.
that was a test of a good driver or a bad driver.
But of course, they were guided with the jerk line.
And what's a jerk line?
Well, one of the lead horses is the one that guides the whole
thing.
Uh-huh. And they were very colorful somewhere. We have pictures of the old freight outfits that George and I have been talking about. We should hunt them up somewhere or other and see that the museum has them.
Yes, this would be real good. Didn't they usually take pride in having matched teams if possible, or?
Not too much, I don't think.
That
but they were, they most practical. Of them, the ones that the pictures were taken of were mostly bays. And the ones that they had, there was one of the, I can still remember, of course I don't suppose I was old enough to know anything about the free outfit, and it must have been, well, it was before I was born, even. I guess it didn't last too long. I don't know just when the railroad came in. Now, one thing they have up in the museum is a silver spike. The railroad definitely came in before 1900. And they have up in the museum now a silver spike, which was the last spike that was drawn in, was put in the branch road that came up here. And Mr. Jeffries, who was the president of the DNRG in those days, was a friend of Mrs. Henry Tompkins, Millicent Tompkins. And when they pulled up the silver spike and he gave it to Mrs. Tompkins with its engraved, the date and everything on it, and the third Mrs. Tompkins, who died just recently, sent that spike to. I haven't seen it. I haven't been in the museum since they've had it, but she sent that spike to the museum, so they still have it up. They have it up there.
I think, and I've seen it, but I've forgotten the notice to date. And
I know it was, now Dad got all of the land, made arrangements for all of the land for the right of way. And when George was born, Mr. Jeffrey sent a silver forager, which is marked the George Lee Beardsley, January 15th, 1900, from, forgot me, his first, his initials, Jeffries. So it was before 1900 that the railroad came in. All right.
What's a forager?
A forager's a silver bowl.
That you had to eat that horrible oatmeal out of?
So, yeah. this has a plate and a bowl.
I thought that's what you were referring to, but I thought, you know, I haven't heard that terminology for so long. I thought I'd check you out there. Well, that's real interesting about the freight line and
originally they brought a railroad up here somewhere in the 80s. And it came up Great Big Canyon, and the terminal was somewhere between Westcliff and Silver Cliff. It used to be you could see the railroad bed in there, know where it was. But it washed out, and they never did anything more about it. And then they brought this one up from Texas Creek.
Mm-hmm. The first one was the narrow gauge, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I didn't know anything about that, and the first one had been washed out, of course, before Dad came. And then the DNRG planned this branch that came here, which was abandoned in
About 36,
I think it was abandoned. That was abandoned in 36, I believe.
Something like that, I remember.
We closed the bank in 37, and I'm pretty sure that the railroad was, I don't know.
I think it was out of existence in 35 or 36.
No, I was just trying to think. I went into the treasurer's office in 35. And I know I had at least two payments from the railroad, tax payments, at least two tax payments from the railroad.
Well, as a youngster, do you remember being thrilled with the train? Did you run down to meet it or anything?
Oh, yes.
Every day, huh?
Well, not every day, but the station agent was a man named Wadley. And his youngest daughter was my best friend.
Sure.
And so I spent a good deal of time down at the branch down at the station.
That's where Evie lives now. She lives downstairs and has an apartment upstairs.
Wadley's lived upstairs and had their living room was downstairs.
I see. Mm-hmm. Did you take quite a few train trips? You probably did.
Well, yes, not too many. We went back to Wisconsin to see Dad's sisters every year or so. And I remember going down to Canyon one time for a circus.
Oh, that was nice.
I wasn't on the train too much.
You weren't a big traveler.
Not a big traveler, except when I went to school, of course, then I came home off for all vacations and whatnot, and that was something rather amusing. A man named Whalen, Mr. Whalen, was the conductor. Had been. He had a ranch here in the valley, and Mr. Whalen was a little plump. He was a little short and rather plump. Anyway, I'd known him always, of course, and took me to Denver school in a car and drove to Denver, but when I came home for Thanksgiving, I came home on the train. Well, the branch train was waiting down at Texas Creek, and I was awful glad to get home. And I greeted Mr. Whalen, almost threw my arms around him, and almost knocked him down. I was so glad to see him. And pretty soon, we started out, and after a while, Mr. Whalen came back to me, and he said, "Well, Paul, he's been away." that took the wind out of my sails.
I kind of leveled you just a little bit. Oh, here you were so happy to return, I didn't even know you'd been gone. That's very discouraging. What other forms of transportation did you ride? Did you ride a horse much?
Oh, we always had horses, and Dad always had horses, so. When he first came, he went back to Kentucky and got a pair of standardbred horses that he drove as a team. He named them after his two nieces in Wisconsin, Adley and Jessie. And Adley and Jessie were pretty nice horses. Dad had a great deal of fun currying them, and we had a whole kind of a fancy double-seated buggy. And
not a carriage.
It wasn't a carriage. No, it was a... I guess you call it... It wasn't a surrey. It could have been a surrey, I guess. It didn't have the fringe on top. It didn't have a cover. But anyway, we spent a good deal of time driving around, and then, of course, we... as soon as George was able to ride, he was given a pony. Of course, before that, we rode donkeys, girls, all the time. But George had his pony, and then I began riding the pony, and George got a larger horse. And we rode always. We always had horses.
You always enjoyed riding.
Yes, very much. I miss it very much now. Thing I loved was riding in the fall on Rainbow Trail. That used to be just wonderful.
Oh, that's one of my ambitions, is to take and ride the length of the Rainbow Trail. I would love to do that.
I haven't gone the full length of the trail. I've gone from below Texas Creek on past Macy.
I've gotten a great deal of it then.
But anyway, I've gotten a good deal of it, and I've gone over a good deal of the time, both the Venable and the Comanche trails, and then I've been on the top of Three Step, too, but of course.
Did you ride bicycles or anything like that?
Oh, yes.
You rode anything that you could ride?
Yeah, we rode bicycles and roller skated.
Roller skated?
When as soon as we got rid of the board sidewalks and had cement sidewalks, we all started roller skating.
I bet that was a big celebration. You didn't let her drive before you were out there skating.
made kind of a mess of the sidewalks first.
Oh, I can just hear the old timers now. Here we put this in and look at those kids wrecking it. Yeah. What's this younger generation coming to? Is that what they say?
Yeah, probably so.
I imagine. I wish you'd tell me some more colorful stories about Uncle Jim, but I don't know if you're going to or not.
I don't know.
Uncle Jim took credit for all these things, and history doesn't give it to him.
No, the Colorado Historical Association.
Did he live to be a very elderly man?
And Uncle Jim died in 19... Now, that's on the tombstones up there, too, which I should have... Barbara, we should have stopped at the cemetery and gotten these figures.
Well, that's all right. I just was a little curious, you know.
Now,
I've heard quite a bit about him, and I thought maybe he had lived to be
He really was
elderly.
Very colorful, though. He was, for one thing, he went up to Alaska almost every year for a good many years, and the mines up there. He'd go up in the summertime and then come back in the winter.
What did he do with his family?
Well, the family stayed in Rosita.
That was nice.
Or went to Canyon. Jesse and Jim were both went to school in Canyon. And they both were in the grade school. I guess there was a grade school up there at that time, but then they did go to high school, I know, in Canyon.
Do you remember any stories your father ever told about extremely big snowstorms or anything along this line in the early days?
No, not particularly, except, of course, my stories are really not historical. I don't know just exactly, but I can remember one when I was quite a small child that was over 3 feet. And at that time, of course, we always had a cow. We didn't get milk. There was milk for sold. Some people sold it, but we always had a cow. And during that snowstorm, my dad was fed 26 cats.
Mm-hmm.
But only one of them stayed. And we had her for a good many years.
I see. How many people lived in the city of West Cliff most of the time you were growing up, would you say? Was it about the size it is now, about 300, or was it larger?
I think it was a little larger, about 500. We always used to say it was 500.
That's just what I thought. Also, now I've heard other people make remarks about so many of the buildings that we have in West Cliff were originally in Silver Cliff.
Yes, a great many of them were.
You were telling me a little bit about the hotel being moved. Would you describe
Well, it was cut in two. The two L's were brought down separately. And most of the houses that were brought down were somehow or other they put them on wagons and brought them down, but the hotel was too big. And I don't know, I think some contractor from out of town was the one that did it. I don't remember about that. But instead of putting it getting it up on wagons, they rolled it down on logs. And I think, as I remember, of course that may not be so too, but as I remember, they put big planks down, put these logs in front of it, and the horses pulled the thing over these logs. And then they'd run down quickly and put the logs down, the planks and the logs on beyond. I know it took quite a long time for them to move it.
It was two-story.
It was a two-story building, yes.
And quite large. I wonder how many rooms. Would you have any idea how many rooms the hotel originally had? I would have guessed around 20 or 25, but I'm not sure.
Well, I don't know that there would be. I'd say around 14. There were two bedrooms downstairs, the parlor and the kitchen and the dining room, which I guess is the same now. I haven't been in for years. And then the lobby. And upstairs there were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I think about 14 bedrooms and 2 baths were put in there.
You didn't have a private bath in those
days. Oh, no.
You
no.
were lucky to find a hotel yeah, with a bath,
bathroom,
right?
You certainly were.
Tell me how cold the hotel
well,
was.
Well, the hotel was a little chilly. And we had the salesman used to come in, and it was drafty, and there were not stoves in the rooms or anything. And the only stove was this great big pot-bellied stove that was out in the lobby. Well, I guess there was a stove in the dining room, but it wasn't as big as the one in the lobby. There was never a Anyway, these men would all come out and sit around the stove in the lobby. And at that time we had a doctor here, a man named Dr. Butterball, who died in Pueblo just a little while ago, within the last year, I think. But he had a goatee. And he was out on a call this one night and came in before he lived across the street from the hotel, but before he went home, he came in to get warm in the stove in the lobby, and here was the goatee with all icicles coming down on it, and the salesman looked up and looked at him, and he said, "My God, what room did you have?" So,
that's a good one. I imagine this pot-bellied stove sort of lended itself to big tall tales.
Well, I expect it did.
I imagine.
I didn't get in on those.
The men probably waited until they left.
Another funny thing about the hotel that always amused me, I don't think there's anything probably that you want to hear about, but...
Sure it is.
But we had a Scotch Collie dog, black and white dog, worth very little, but very pleasant animal, but she was scared to death of thunder and lightning, and would go anywhere. Her name was Pluto. Pluto, this one night, after a storm, Pluto didn't come home, and we thought sometimes she got locked in the vault. She sent storms in there a good deal.
Oh,
we didn't. And she had enough air, so we didn't go down and get her. But anyway, during the middle of the night, salesman in one of the downstairs bedrooms of the hotel woke up and heard something under his bed, and I guess the moon was shining, or the light, there wasn't any light, I guess the moon was shining enough so he could look out, and all of a sudden here this great black thing came out from under his bed, stood up in bed and landed in the dining room. was a bear.
He thought the old bad man had him, didn't he?
Yeah.
Oh, well, Pluto found a good place to hide, that's all. Well, oh, one other thing I wanted to make sure that I got. Your mother's people were Swedish.
Yes.
What about your father? What nationality was he?
Well, I'm not that sure.
Oh.
I think probably we would say English in the long run. They
I thought
been there.
It was the English name in the family.
It was, we always laughed at George. He always insisted that, we insisted that they were Pennsylvania Dutch. But from Pennsylvania, it was during it, they came from that part of Pennsylvania where the Dutch settlement was, part of it. My grandmother's, my father's mother's name was Wells, and I doubt it was Dutch.
I think they were
English.
For the most part, English.
English, yes.
Okay. Barbara, do you think anything else we haven't covered? We've skipped around so much, I know, a little bit.
Right.
Now we're going to try a little contrast here and talk a little bit about ranch.
Well, the only thing I remember, of course, Dad had a hay ranch from the time I could remember. We used to drive, we thought it was 2.5 miles from town, and we used to drive out very frequently. The old house, which burned after Dad sold it, was a comfortable old house, and there were a lot of barns and trails and machine shop and old building where they smoked the hams and the bacon and everything, and all the time I had, and I guess all the time Dad had the place. The man that was on the place was a man named Bob Tyler, and he really ran the place, except Dad was there a great deal of the time, and it was where there was some grain put in, but most of it was hay and feeding cattle in some of the pastures. But the hay was put up by, was contracted by Mexicans from Gardner. And every Gallo day, Dad would drive down to Gardner and get his crew, and they'd bring up all the whole families, and all of them lived in the granary. And then they'd, of course, the mowers were just, of course, they were all horse-drawn. All of the equipment was horse-drawn. And the ones I remember, of course, there were mowers and then the buck rakes. And the ones I remember particularly, they didn't have these hay loaders or anything of that kind. They just came along with the hay rack and threw it in with pitchforks and then threw it off with pitchforks. And Dad had was one of the people that always stacked his hay in hay yards, great long stacks of hay. And one of the first things I remember doing with Dad and feeling important was holding the end of the tape while he measured the haystacks to get the amount in the haystacks.
I see.
And for years and years, he'd measure the length, the width, and the over. And for years and years, all the time he was alive and all the time we were in the bank, and even after I went to the treasurer's office, we figured hay for people here in the valley, how many tons there were. There was a government rule, and then there was the rule they called the Jersey rule. And Dad had figured it by bailing out the hay, that the rule that he used really was more accurate than the government rule. And all of these people that contracted hay, it showed a little bit more hay in the stacks than the government rule. And all the people that contracted wanted to figure by the Beardsley rule, and I'd like a nickel for every stack of hay I figured in my life.
That's real interesting. Never even thought about that particular aspect. How large was your ranch?
A few
acres, right? Probably.
It's the same to the next lane, and then it's extended just beyond here, where the first fence is, clear to the next lane over. Didn't go into the what we used to call the Rocky Lane. I just don't know how many acres there were in it. I think it's probably the same.
But you did raise some cattle, any particular kind?
Well, they were herbers for the most part. At one time, and I don't remember just what it was, Dad bought quite a few Black Angus. And they were not satisfactory at that time.
You better say at that time.
Well, what?
Because we really like them now.
Well, that's what I know. Black Angus has become very popular. But the ones Dad got, he got from Gunnison. And he preferred the Herefords. I mean, he felt that, I don't know, of course, the strain's been improved on any of these cattle, you know, so definitely Herefords and everything else.
And they get lots more care than they used to.
But at that time, he felt that they was too much trouble keeping them in the pasture. They were the kind that got out.
Kind of like to wander around.
Yeah.
Oh, well, we did have some heifers here a while back. We did the same thing. Stay any place but in the
So,
well, let's see.
And, of course, when they threshed, as I say, they planted enough grain, oats, to take care of the horses used on the farm and on the ranch, and also our horses, the team, and the saddle horses that we had. We always had enough oats for that. I don't remember that there was anything more. And then they raised enough wheat for chickens, our own chickens and the chickens out on the ranch. And I don't remember that they raised any other kind of grain. But it was really quite something when the thresher came.
When they thrashed, yes.
That was fun.
That engine was something. It made a nice noise, and it was so huge, right?
Yes, indeed.
And
the thresher was so huge, too.
Oh,